It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is off. From tweets to Facebook, smartphones to 24-hour news cycles, we are awash in information. Research shows that today we absorb 5 times as much data every day as we did 30 years ago. That's the equivalent of reading 174 newspapers a day, cover to cover. And while data drives our information age, it leaves us staggering with information overload. So how do we navigate the deluge of information that comes at us every day and avoid becoming anxious and scatterbrained as a result? With us now is Daniel Levitin, neuroscientist and dean of arts and humanities at the Minerva Schools at KGI. His latest book is called The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
So I think most of us have a rough idea about how to, say, organize our sock drawer, but how do we organize our mind?
Well, I think part of the idea is to think about all the different things we have to do. And there are dozens of things we could talk about, but one is rather obvious, and that is to prioritize. Don't do first thing in the day the things that are least important, because you may find at the end of the day you haven't done the things that are most important.
I want to zoom in on what's actually happening in our brains as we try to process all this information. What happens during the day as we both pay attention to tasks that we hope to complete that are a priority and, you know, things that are humming along in the background? What's going on inside the skull?
Oh, that's a great question. So there are two principal modes of the brain's attentional system. One is, we're familiar with both of them. One of them is that we are engaged in a task, we're paying close attention, we're not distracted, and neuroscientists call this the task positive network. It's when we're engaged in a task. And this alternates throughout the day with another mode called the task negative network. When you're not actually working on something, your mind is wandering instead. And it turns out these form a kind of a yin-yang of your attentional set, and they're both necessary. If through an act of will, through deliberate willpower, we try to stay engaged in a task all day long, or a series of tasks, and never give our brain a chance to go to that other mode, we find ourselves fatigued and depleted, because it's that daydreaming mode that is restorative.
So sort of like, you know, regular dreaming is supposed to reset us a little bit too. Daydreaming, unhooking from the harness a little bit, can help too.
Right. And one of the ways that unhooking from that harness can help is that the daydreaming mode is often the source of our greatest insights into problem solving. So you can think about this logically. If you're working on a problem and you're unable to solve it, and you keep trying and you feel like you're hitting your head against the wall and you disengage from it, as soon as the daydreaming mode takes it on, the daydreaming mode is very good at finding connections among things that we didn't see were connected before. And the solutions to many problems require that kind of thinking as opposed to the linear logical thinking of the task positive network.
Now, you also write about something called the attentional filter. How does that aspect of the brain work?
In addition to these two modes, there is a filter running almost all the time in the background that's paying attention or scanning the environment for anything that might be urgent or important. Evolutionarily speaking, this might be the sound of an approaching lion, the sound of an approaching mate, any kind of a predator or enemy. And as you've noticed probably, whether you're daydreaming or whether you're engaged in a task, certain things capture your attention. You know, the proverbial shiny objects that attract a baby's attention. For us, it can be a sudden loud sound, which captures us and directs our attention towards that. This is a third component of the attentional system.
So given all that, how much harder is it today to process information in the so-called information age than it was 20, 30 years ago?
Well, as you said in the introduction, there's so much more information coming in. The average American watches 5 hours of television a day. That's a lot of images and a lot of dialogue. As you said, we're reading the equivalent of 174 newspapers every day. We're taking in either through reading or listening and encountering different factoids in the environment. So so it's very, very difficult to, it's more information than we can process, very difficult to keep up. So one of the things we can do is take breaks, make more time during the day to clear our minds and effectively hit the neural reset button.
So what kind of breaks are you talking about? I mean, a lot of us have demanding jobs where it could be hard to step away for a while and just say, you tell your boss, I'm taking a brain break. They may not buy it. There's so much work on the table. What does it take to reset the brain in one of these breaks?
Well, so we can take a lesson from air traffic controllers. I think we can agree that this is a very high stress, very high tension job, right? Where they've got a lot of things going on, there's lots of information coming at them, and if their attention lags for even a minute, the consequences can be disastrous. And it's no coincidence that air traffic controllers, by regulation, are only allowed to work 45 to 60 minutes at a stretch, and then they have to take a 15 to 30-minute break. And it's been shown in many, many research studies that these kinds of breaks are restorative to the brain, to efficiency. They increase your effective IQ, and they reduce accidents. Now, even though you and I don't have jobs where there's so much at stake, as an air traffic controller does, the same principle applies. So if you're sitting in your office with your legs, your feet on the desk, looking out the window, and your boss comes by, you could point to the dozens of studies I cite in the book about how in a variety of environments, based on carefully controlled experiments, people are more productive at the end of the day if they've been able to take those breaks than if they were forced to plow on through.
Can you tell us about a couple of those studies?
Well, so in one study, workers are made to work the way they have always worked. In other studies, workers are allowed to take naps, for example, even just one 10 or 15-minute nap in the middle of the day, whenever they want. And at the end of the day, the two groups' work output is compared, and the ones who took the naps not only did more work, but the quality of the work was better.
So taking a little nap would be fantastic. Not exactly workplace culture, but it does get at this idea that, resetting your brain with one of these little breaks could really help. But what about, let's say you take your break, you grab your smartphone, and you're checking your texts, and you're flipping through Facebook. Does that count?
Yeah, that's not a break. That's more of the same overstimulation and over-distraction. The most effective breaks, Veronica, are if you can take a walk in nature, if you so happen to be working in a place where you can step outside and there's trees or a body of water, any natural kind of landscape, or just to look at a picture of nature, or to listen to music, not the kind of rousing music that makes you want to exercise, but kind of music that makes your mind wander. Or, as I say, naps, other activities that help, or meditation. And all of this is proven to work. And you're talking about corporate culture. At least in California, a number of companies are setting up a culture of being able to take these breaks and naps. Safeway Stores, big grocery chain, has done this. Google and Minerva Schools at KGI, the new undergraduate program as part of the Claremont Consortium, has a nap room.
Wow.
And I use it often.
Can you force yourself into going into one of these daydream mode breaks? What happens if you can't get your mind out of that rut where it's just ruminating about work?
Yeah, that's a problem. So many of us in this over-caffeinated and highly driven time, when we turn away from work, we feel like we can't relax. We feel like if we're not working all the time, we're falling behind. Part of the problem is that, so many of us now, when we're at work, we're thinking about being at home. When we're at home, we're thinking about being at work. And so we're really in neither place. The key, what I'm talking about with the organized mind, isn't turning all of us into a bunch of Mr. Spocks from Star Trek. Not turning us into a bunch of automatons that are, robotic and completely focused. What I'm talking about is adopting a kind of habit of mind of working your best when you're at work, so that at the end of the day, the end of the workday, you can leave it behind you and then make more time in your life for spontaneity, for leisure, for fun, and for the relationships that are important to you.
And another thing that you recommend is sort of compartmentalizing, especially at work. Looking at your email all at once is one example. What are some other things that we can do?
Well, so the big problem is that for most of us at work, and I think this applies across a broad spectrum of jobs that people have, it probably doesn't apply so much to taxi drivers or publicists or air traffic controllers, as we mentioned, but most of us in our jobs, to do them well, we need to sustain some concentration for a period of time. And if we're constantly being distracted by that ping of email or texting or tweets, there's Instagram, Facebook news feeds, Vine, Pinterest, Tumblr, all of that breaks your concentration, and it means that you're less efficient and less able to do quality work. You asked a moment ago, how do you get into this daydreaming mode, or how do you disengage? Part of it is comes with, I guess I would say, adopting a mindset or a practice of making these partitions that you mentioned, Veronica. So if you do your email just in two blocks during the day, you set aside a time for it, you're not being interrupted by that constant ping of a new message. Same with social networking. Set up a special time when you do it. Now, in your particular job, that may not be possible. A journalist or a publicist, your job description requires that you're engaged at every minute. You're probably following six or eight feeds at once, right?
Yep. That's pretty much true.
And so in jobs like that, I think you have to talk to your boss about, and I hope your boss is listening, talk to your boss about adopting the air traffic controller model. There's another job where people do this and breaks are required. One of the most stressful jobs there is being a simultaneous translator at the UN. Because if you get one word wrong, it could mean a war. So you're taking in the information in one language, you're spitting it out in another, you're trying to watch body language. And those workers aren't allowed to work more than an hour to stretch either.
Interesting. Well, lots of different models to consider. Well, we're going to continue talking about this with our guest, Daniel Levitin. His latest book is called The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. And we'd love to hear from you on this. How do you cope with information overload? Do you simply switch off your devices? Do you have other coping techniques that you share? And do you believe in the value of a nap? Of a daydream? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're talking right now about coping with information overload with Daniel Levitin. His latest book is called The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. And we'd be happy to hear from you now. Do you have questions about how all of this works, how to incorporate it into your daily life, as apparently all of us read the equivalent of 174 newspapers cover to cover a day? That's the kind of information we're dealing with. Do you feel fatigued because of that? Do you think there could be a better way? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org. And Daniel, you talked to some fascinating people as you were writing this book, and one of them was former Secretary of State George Shultz. What did he have to tell you about organizing the mind?
He had been president of Bechtel Corporation in the 1980s, and he's a very organized, clear thinker. And I learned a lot from him and a fellow board member, Edmund Littlefield, about how they can be efficient and still have plenty of leisure time. And it had to do with taking notes on little 3x5 cards. Their to-do list would tend to be written on cards. And they could shuffle them or sort them throughout the day as the priorities changed. And this is now recognized by neuroscientists as a very foundational principle of trying to be organized in your mind and in your life, and that is get things out of your head whenever you can and put them out there in the world, because the conscious mind can really only attend to a handful of things at a time. If you put it out on paper or you have some reminders out there in the world, it frees up your mind to be more effective.
So,
he said something else about military intervention. I didn't know if you were referring to that.
Well, that's interesting as well, yeah.
Well, he told me last summer something that I found really surprising and wonderful, actually. Reflecting on 40 years of United States foreign policy around the world, he said if he had it all to do over again, you remember he was Secretary of State, not to mention Secretary of the Treasury, if he had it all to do over again, instead of spending so much American money on bombs and weaponry, especially in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq, he would have started in the 1970s building schools and hospitals so that the citizens there would love Americans rather than hate them.
That's a really interesting point. And we're going to go now to our phone lines, and John is with us from Houstonsford. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is that I am a maintenance electrician, and we often find ourselves in stressful, high-pressure situations. And at my work, we work 10.5-hour days, and our lunchtime comes, and we eat our lunchtime. I try to finish the crossword puzzle or the crypto quip, and at 15 minutes past the hour, I just shut my eyes, take a little short nap during lunch hour, and I found that it is absolutely the key to getting through the rest of a 10.5-hour day. It really does work, and it's true, and I 100% agree that if you can shut your eyes for a second and just turn yourself off, it reenervates you.
Oh, well, thank you so much,
John,
for calling.
John, it gets easier with practice, right? It might have been hard the first few times, but then you ease into it.
Oh, absolutely. It gets easier with practice, and to be quite honest with you, it's very common for our coworkers to stop in if their lunchtime is a little bit different, and it throws you off balance because you didn't get to just shut your eyes and put your feet up for a second, and it kind of throws you off balance. So pretty much everybody who comes in there knows that, you know, we're going to shut our eyes for 15 minutes and just leave us alone. And it works out, and I absolutely agree with your thinking.
All right. Well, thank you, John. John is someone who's put that to the test, and I think it's something a lot of us consider, but it's hard to actually try. But it's interesting to hear from John there about actually doing it and getting results. And Daniel, I want to ask you about education. What does all this have to say about the way that we practice education in America? Should we be doing things differently to help kids organize themselves and organize their brains?
Well, we should. I devote a chapter to this in the book because one of the consequences of the information age and information overload is that things are changing so rapidly that it no longer makes sense to try and teach the compendium of facts that we used to teach school children because facts are changing. What we know about genetics, for example, has changed so dramatically in the last 20 years. If you had taken a class in it 20 years ago, half of what you learned is no longer taught. So our mission as educators and as parents has to shift from trying to cram a bunch of facts into the heads of kids into teaching them to be critical thinkers. This is exactly what we're doing at Minerva at the undergraduate level, is teaching critical thinking skills, habits of mind for being good consumers of information, to be able to know how to use information effectively and creatively to help solve the world's problems.
Well, could you tell us a little bit about that? How do you do that? How do you teach someone to be a critical thinker?
Well, we've identified over 140 different aspects of critical thinking. And each class, we teach those. We teach content, too, like history and calculus and physics. But the emphasis is on how to use these critical thinking skills. I'll give you an example. Critical thinking involves information literacy. If you hear a report, what you should do automatically, what any educated person should do automatically, is think to themselves, what is the source of this information? Is it a valid source? What's the evidence for the assertion? How do we know that the person telling us hasn't adulterated it? Could the person have any biases that might make them want to report something in one way rather than another?
Okay, so you look right at the facts and you try to analyze them then and there, and you're working, I guess, what does that do in the brain?
Well, it keeps the brain active in a critical mode. Critical, of course, doesn't always mean being negative. but it means wanting to have evidence for the things that you're asked to believe. And this helps people to become more confident in their own abilities, especially children. It builds self-confidence. It builds a kind of independence of thought that really is the foundation of a free society. The idea behind a free electorate and an informed electorate is that we're able to handle the information that we're given and use that information to make decisions about how we want to be governed.
Daniel, appreciate you joining us today. It's been fascinating.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Daniel Levitin. His latest book is called The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, in our Food Friday segment, we'll discuss how to make a salad hearty and yummy enough to be considered a main course. But first, the police shooting of an unarmed black teen in Ferguson, Missouri last week has highlighted the frustrations of some African-American communities over what they describe as unequal treatment by police. Protesters have written the words Black Men Matter on the pavement in Ferguson, and voices from the African-American community have begun speaking up about the experience of being a black man in America and what it means to prepare African-American children for a world that might view them with suspicion. Joining us now is Dr. Alex G., head of the Justified Anger Coalition. He's also the founder of a nonprofit community empowerment program called Nehemiah and senior pastor of Fountain of Life Church. Pastor G., welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what did you think when you heard about the shooting of Michael Brown last week? What went through your mind?
I thought a couple of things. I thought, that poor mom, that family, that young man. And the second thought was, here we go again. Sadly, that was what I thought. Here we go again. And thirdly, at what point are we going to begin to really assess the value of the life of African-American men?
It's an interesting point, one that has been taken up by yourself and by others. As I said in the introduction, in Ferguson, protesters have been writing phrases like Black Men Matter on the sidewalks, and that is one theme that is emerging here. As a society, do we devalue black men as you see it?
I think so. I think we do. I mean, obviously. Now, I mean, what I'm about to suggest is hypothetical, of course, but I just... You know, in the black community, we will witness a situation, and then we will try to juxtapose it with the black reality. So I ask myself, if a black cop had shot an unarmed white gentleman, would we have known his name by now? We would have known, my opinion, his name, his family's name, his background, what his grandmother did for a living, where his kids went to school, whether or not his kids dropped out. We'd know everything about their family. And so when I look at the treatment of this situation, nothing of it resembles a value of the life of a black male. I'm not saying that everyone discards it, but I'm saying it is certainly not valued the same way an 18-year-old unarmed college freshman white male would be valued.
James Causey of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel recently wrote a piece about how parents have to prepare their sons to go out into the world as African-American men. Things like how to behave around police to keep their hands within view, how to handle suspicion in a store and to expect it. Is this something that you think some African-American families are reading and looking at each other and nodding?
Oh, of course. I mean, this isn't even extracurricular. This is right up there with wash your hands after going to the bathroom, ask to be excused from the table, say yes, ma'am, or no, ma'am. When the police pull you over, keep your hands at 10 and 2. I'm 50 years old, and I do that. When I'm pulled over, I was pulled over a couple of years ago in front of our church door, and I was infuriated. I was embarrassed. My white associate was in the same parking lot waiting for me. In fact, he was the only car there. And when I arrived, the police pulled me over and started asking questions. I knew that I had the chief of police on speed dial. I knew that I had friends in the department. I knew that there were officers who were members and leaders in my church. But the fact that if I acted frustrated or as angry as if I presented my level of anger, that I would somehow seem to be acquiescing to a level of guilt culpability, and my actions can be misread. And so, as a grown man with an advanced degree, and I'm from this community and have served this community, I still want to make sure that I am above suspicion when I'm stopped. So, of course, that comes way back from training. In fact, my white associate got out of his car and walked over to my car while I was being questioned, and I thought, and I laughed to myself, I said, I can tell that he's not a black male, because as much as I care for him, black men are taught you do not get out of your car while a police officer stops someone else and walk up on them. Not because you're going to get shot if you do that. That's not what I'm suspicious of in Madison. But it goes through your mind because it happens in places. And the fact that when I'm stopped, I want a camera on, I want to dial someone on speakerphone. Just last week, I told my daughter, who's a 17-year-old young lady, if you're pulled over by the police, if where you're driving, put your hazards on so they know that they see you, but drive to a well-lit area. Do not pull over on a side road where it's dark and no one's around. Put your flasher on, call 911 to let them know, hey, I'm being pulled over, but I'm pulling into a gas station. But I had this conversation with my daughter last week. I would have told my son if I had one even more than that.
Now, those are conversations you're talking about that I expect are not common to a lot of Caucasians in this country. What does that say to you about the state of things, of race relations and the relationships between law enforcement and African-American families?
It says we got a long ways to go. It says that we have two realities. It says that this is not new to the black community, and this is how we train our kids to cope with it. And it says that our white counterparts are oblivious to it. And because they never have to do it, they're suspicious when we say we do. And so not only is it a difference of reality, but I think it creates the chasm between us and makes the conversations of reconciliation more difficult, because I think our white counterparts are oblivious to it, because that sounds like make-believe. What do you mean 10 and 2? What do you mean you want to call someone while the police are pulling you over? If you've done nothing, just pull over and answer the question. That's never the issue. In being pulled over by the police, I have never been cited. I've never been given a warning that my taillight was out, that my plates were out. When I've been pulled over for what they call suspicious behavior, they let me go once running my plates, but they never gave me a warning because I never did anything wrong in those cases. Now, if I'm speeding, that's different. That's a different situation. But I'm just saying, if in the two times I've been pulled over in Madison within two blocks of my church office, I was never given a warning because I hadn't done anything wrong.
Do you see this as a consciousness-raising moment for us as a nation, a time to claim value and humanity for African-American men in particular?
I think it is. And I wish I could think of a word that's probably stronger than conscious-raising. I think there needs to be a willingness to accept the fact that there are dual realities in this country. And so we need an understanding that would awaken that consciousness. And so, yes, to answer your question, we certainly do, but I don't know. I wish I could. I'm at a loss for words. I wish I could think of something stronger than just conscious awareness building. It's so blatant that I think it's hard for our white counterparts to believe that these realities are true, and they believe in such meritocracy that you cannot be skilled in upper middle class, an advanced degree, and pulled over just because of your car or your skin. That cannot happen in the United States of America in 2014. So I think that there's some real burying of their heads in the sand regarding this. So I think we need more than just an awakening of consciousness. We need some truth telling. We need some truth serum to say this really is happening. It's overwhelming. We can't fully explain it, but we're tired of pretending like this doesn't happen. It is now too blatant to think that this is just purely coincidental.
Now, as a country, a lot of people would agree that we have been having some tough conversations about race, especially because of President Barack Obama and the questions that his race brought to the surface. Would you say that is the tip of the iceberg?
I think it's the tip of the iceberg. I think the fear of many African Americans when Barack Obama was elected as our president was that people would, not just the black people, but the white people would sing their version of Kumbaya, that we have overcome and now we have proven that we are a post-racial society. We have all realized that what it's done is unveiled our proclivity to be racist, to be divided, and to hide our racial views in in political rhetoric, that we call it political politics, we call it other things, but it has a lot to do with race and ethnicity. And so we have shown that we can have this kind of election in our country, and I'm proud of it. But I think we have all deluded ourselves, and we think we no longer have a problem and no longer have to talk about it. That's the setback that I think we've experienced since President Obama's election, that we have somehow accepted this false reality that we have arrived.
What would you like to see happen at this moment in time, or at least begin at this moment in time, so that everyone emerges with greater understanding and compassion and awareness?
I would like to see greater accountability from the governor of Missouri on down. What's the training? What's the accountability? What's the culpability? What does it mean to be put on administrative leave? This officer doesn't want his name shared because he fears profiling. Yet most black boys in America fear profiling. I want to see people explain how they could have 2/3 of their population be black and only 3 or 4 of their police force black. I want people to say what they were thinking, how this happens on their watch, and how this continues to take place. I don't want to just talk about the black response. I don't want to just talk about what the black community needs. I want white leaders to say, this is inherently wrong. We thought that we were beyond this. We thought that we had hired the best people. We were shocked by this behavior, and it will be dealt with. I think what makes it so difficult is that the average black person has no confidence that this white gentleman will be brought to justice. That's not even in my mind. And if he is duly brought to justice, I'd probably be the first to apologize. I might even actually say it's about time. But there is nothing within my consciousness that is expecting that he will lose his job, lose his pension, and suffer true consequences for his action. That's what makes this so unconscionable for our country. And I want people to address how that can continue to happen on our watch. We saw it in Florida. We saw it with Zimmerman. We're watching this happen. And this brings up all of those old fears, and it just helps us to lose hope, causes us to lose hope for how we move ahead. So I just want some real accountability, and I want someone to say, we're wrong. This is wrong. This is bad. We have messed up, and we're going to gut this department. We're going to gut this administration. We're going to do this right, and we're going to have the community show us and guide us in doing this. This needs to be a radical surgery, and not just something that's topical. This is an embarrassment in this day and time that my daughter sends me a text message when I'm at work saying, Daddy, I'm scared. She thinks we stepped back into the 50s, and she's wrong. We stepped back into the 40s.
And we have to leave it there. Dr. G, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And we have learned, of course, that the Ferguson authorities have identified the officer involved in the shooting, and we'll continue to watch this story. We've been talking with Dr. Alex G., senior pastor of Fountain of Life Church. He's also the head of the Justified Anger Coalition. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. This is Food Friday. We're taking a look at how to make salads that are hearty enough and yummy enough to be considered entrees. Usually the first thing that comes to mind when you think about a salad entree is something with grilled chicken on it. That's sort of the standard. But Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies, says there are lots of other and better kinds of main course salads. And she's here to share some of them with us. She's been cooking up a storm here at WPR this entire week. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So what were you thinking when you were at the starting block here? You wanted to make something that was a salad, had to be hearty, had to be delicious. How did you start?
And considering that when I brought this topic up, about 80% of the respondents immediately said, oh, you mean like a grilled chicken Caesar? It's like, okay, well, obviously we have the green component, the lettuce component, but the first thing people thought of is something with protein added to the greens. So I was starting to develop recipes where protein would be a focus, but I also thought that you needed to have some kind of starch. You needed to have some kind of heft to it, whether it's soba noodles or pasta or potatoes or what we ended up working with, a lot of different grains.
Yeah.
one lovely thing about having grains in your entree salad is this is something that will help you make it ahead of time. It will hold on to however you're dressing it. And then if you want to add more delicate things, you can do that at the end. But a really great thing about an entree salad is it takes a lot of the panic of preparation out of the kitchen. You can do this when you have the time. The other lovely thing is those of us who are grilling now, if you end up grilling just a little bit too much protein, using that extra in an entree salad is a great way to use it up. Have your grains, have some really good veggies, have a nice vinaigrette, and oh, I'm so sorry, we made one extra piece of skirt steak on the grill. I guess we're just going to have to slice it up and put it on the salad.
Well, I think you made some converts to salads around here at WPR, and I'm actually a new convert to smoked trout, but that was the very first, I think it was the first salad you made, a smoked trout salad, and you've got your grain, you had your wild rice in there. Tell us how that one came together.
This one was really Wisconsin-centric. Wild rice, which we get from Wisconsin. I used dried cherries in it, which could come from Door County, but of course dried cranberries would work as well. And then smoked trout. There is one wonderful vendor from Artisan Trout Farms. I talked to her at the farmer's market one Saturday, and she was very excited to think about smoked trout being used in a salad. We toss this with greens and sliced toasted almonds and diced apple. She was very, very specific that when you put this all together, start with your vinaigrette in the bottom of the bowl and then add your stuff on top of it. She says it makes it a lot easier to incorporate everything when the vinaigrette is first.
Oh, really?
And so I tried that, and it did seem to work, so I'm keeping that in mind. This was a salad that used 8 ounces of smoked trout with a cup of wild rice that was then cooked.
Pre-cooked.
And was definitely more than a cup once it got in the bowl. A lot of people told me they found the taste to be very pleasing. But this was a little too light for an entree. I had several people say it'd make a great appetizer, but not everybody was convinced that this was a great entree salad. You mentioned that
I'm
really
sold.
Loved it.
I'm sold. Okay. I thought it was delicious. It had the protein. I suppose you could add more smoked trout if you wanted to up that factor of
or
if, someone suggested croutons.
Or if you want... Don't do smoked trout. Use salmon. Use, again, salmon on the grill or salmon that had been poached. There, the pieces of protein can be bigger. And with this, I just used a basic lemon shallot vinaigrette. But somebody said you want to punch it up a little, do a creamy horseradish dressing as well. So that would definitely give it a bit of a kick.
I'm in love with it. I don't want you to change anything. Don't touch it. Well, and as much as I loved that one, I have to say the thing that people were shouting about in the hallways was the salad that you made today. So I want to get to that next.
All right.
This was a salad that doesn't sound very sexy if I just say what's in it, but it really came together and was spectacular. Quinoa lentil salad.
I was inspired to try this from a food blogger in Copenhagen, Sarah Britton. Her blog is called My New Roots, and she had something in there from a couple of years ago called the best lentil salad in the world. And I added a few things, and I took out a few things, and it's a combination of quinoa and French lentils, Dupuy lentils, which cook up a little firmer than others. And firmness is a key with this salad. I put in red onion and carrot, currants and walnuts. And then there was the vinaigrette, which is the spiciest vinaigrette I have ever made. And it was amazing.
What's in it?
Extra virgin olive oil, apple cider vinegar, maple syrup, spicy brown mustard, salt, pepper, cumin, turmeric, coriander, cardamom, cayenne, ground cloves, grated nutmeg, and cinnamon.
I should have said, what isn't in it?
Well, what surprised me, there was no ginger, there was no garlic, which are things that I usually go for in a vinaigrette. This didn't need it. Somebody called it the best salad she'd ever had. I made a huge bowl of this. It could easily feed six people as an entree. And she said she could eat the whole bowl.
And it had your quinoa, which is very popular now because it has a lot of protein. Of course, the lentils have protein, and then the goat cheese has protein. So you're really, it felt healthy, and it also felt like it didn't feel like health food. And I have to point out right now that this recipe is up on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm going to be making it soon. I know that for a fact. Did it surpass your expectations, Lori?
Absolutely. This was one where you could do the quinoa and the lentils and the onion and carrot ahead of time. I threw in some chopped arugula, chopped basil, and then, as you mentioned, the goat cheese right at the end, added some extra dressing. And yeah, this was just a party in everybody's mouth. I will throw this out to the Central Time listening audience. If you make this salad and you can come up with a better name than quinoa lentil salad, go ahead and send it in, because we would love to find a great name for this. This is so much fun to eat and so easy to put together.
Right. I think this is a salad that will outlive us all. You've outdone yourself this time, Lori.
Well, I'll definitely be making it this weekend. We've got friends coming over and I want them to try this.
Good picnic salad?
Absolutely. This is one so easy to do because it can be served at room temperature. You don't have to worry about anything being chilled.
Perfect. Well, Lori, thank you so much for coming on, and thank you for all the cooking.
Absolutely.
Spectacular. Spectacular food week here at Wisconsin Public Radio. That was Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is off today. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.